We want the truth, so watch Truth Wanted live Fridays at 7 p.m. Central. Visit tiny.cc/yttw and call into the show at 512-991-9242 or connect to the show online at tiny.cc/calltw. So you think that you could tell us how to live our lives, never questioning the thoughts from which your moral code derives. You think that suffering is part of some great plan that's been devised. I wonder what will it take for you to start.
Hello and welcome to the Atheist Experience live from the Freethought Library in Austin, Gilead. I mean, Saudi Arabia. Oh, wait, no, we're in Texas, aren't we? I'm your host, Jim Barrows, and joining me today is Christy Powell. How's it going, Christy?
Hey, howdy, hey. I am just so excited to be here doing this, like, in the studio with all of these good people. There's so many folks I haven't seen in so long. It's been amazing.
I agree with you. It must be doubly because you're normally on Thursdays, and here it is a Sunday, and you're in the...
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's exciting to get, like, out of the broom closet, the, you know, whatever crappy studio space we've been able to scrounge up to have all this fancy equipment and all these fancy people. It's great.
Yeah. It is absolutely awesome to see a bunch of faces out there in the audience, finally and again. And it is a little bit weird and a little bit wonderful and
there's some rust to shake off. You know, we've taken the studio out of mothballs. We've got everything up and running, but I don't know. I might need a little bit of time to get back into it.
Well, you know, not only are we in live from the Freethought Library, we also have another announcement for everyone to pay attention to, and that is something that's going to drop tomorrow. And do you know what that is?
I so do. I'm so excited to hear you say it, though.
The Bat Cruise. Pay attention tomorrow. Watch our Facebook pages. You'll get details. And I will tell you right now, it's not going to be as big as it was 2 years ago, the last time we did it. So pay attention. Get your tickets fast. And pay attention to that because that information will be dropping tomorrow. But the Bat Cruise will be this in August, towards the end of August. And we'll do that on Saturday. And then everyone come to the shows, too. It is limited tickets. Work fast. And pay attention tomorrow for that to drop because we're still finalizing some details. So, you know, it may be close of business tomorrow. It may be early Tuesday morning. But do pay attention for our Bat Cruise announcement coming up. And, yes, that will be here in Austin, Gilead. I mean, Texas. the Atheist Experience is a product of the Atheist Community of Austin, which is a 501c3 organization dedicated to the promotion of positive atheist culture and separation of religion and government. So not only are we live, but we can also do and talk to live on the show folks that are here in studio.
Mm-hmm.
And our very, very first conversation is going to be with a person here in the studio. And I believe it is Aaron from Texas. Yes, there we go. Go ahead, ask your question. We can't hear you. Now I can hear you. All right. Technical difficulties. All right, here we go.
To be here at the AOA and...
ACA?
Yeah, the ACA. And, how did you guys come to be here?
I drove a car. I'm sorry. I should not do that. I left Phoenix 4 years ago now, and I was part of the Human Society for Greater Phoenix there, first atheist organization when I decided that I wanted to hang out with more atheists. And then I was able to sell my home finally and look for some place to live, and Austin came up, and then I started hanging out here at the Freethought Library every Sunday, sometimes throughout the week. And I was here for during a nonprofit shooting, and they needed somebody, and I sat down. And then the next thing I know, I'm on Talk Ethan and AXP and doing the shows. So that's kind of my origin story.
That's a little bit of a rite of passage, right?
Yes.
They're getting ready to do nonprofits, and to just sort of scan the audience, and then years later, you find yourself still here. No, I was recruited a little bit. The idea had been floated around by a handful of people. We wanted to do a sex show. We started talking to Dr. Daryl Ray about the show he had been doing, and I think it honestly initially started with just a Google search for, like, Austin sex therapist willing to volunteer for free. And then that went down the grapevine a handful of times until I met a couple of good people from the organization, and they brought me in over the summer to talk about a show, and I was very much on the fence. And then I was here prepping for the show we were going to maybe do months down the road, and they needed somebody to do nonprofits, and I jumped in and had a blast. So we've been working on secular sexuality Thursday nights at 7 since then, and I've just gotten, I guess, more and more passionate about the work that the ACA as a whole is doing. So I'm just terribly proud to be here in the library for the first atheist experience in years. It's pretty amazing.
It is really, really cool. Really, really cool to be here. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Got any more for us?
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, we're always looking for volunteers. And there's a couple of spots on the nonprofits available from time to time. So,
good news, you may or may not end up on a show. Bad news, you may or may not end up on a show.
Yeah.
But if you guys like what we do and would like to support us, here are some of the ways to support the Atheist Experience and the atheist community of Austin. You can become a member for as little as 99 cents a month. Click the join button below this video. That'll give you access to special chat emojis and all kinds of good stuff. And this is just one of the shows put on by the ACA. Make sure to check out other shows as well. As Christy just pointed out, Secular Sexuality, Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central. And folks, it's always Thursday. Truth Wanted airs live Fridays at 7, and then we have our Sunday shows. Talk Heathen airs at 1, and Nonprofits right before this show at 3 p.m. Central. And, of course, you can support us on Patreon at tiny.cc/PatreonAXP. Ready for our first call?
All right, yeah, let's totally do it.
Okay, let's see who we're going to take here. Let's take the Christian callers first. Mm-hmm. There we go. All right, so we're going to talk to Rodney in Michigan. What do you want to talk about, Rodney?
Hi, how are you guys doing? Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to first find out, like, what the show is actually about. I found it a couple months ago.
The Experience of Atheists?
Is this actually a show that's looking for someone to prove God, or is it just an atheist show?
No, I mean, we'd love it if you could. Like, yeah. People have tried. If you can today, let's do it. I might recommend you to check out who you're calling before you call, but you're here now. We're glad to hear from you. What do you got for us?
Well, I've been a Christian all my life. Mm-hmm. I'm 53 now. I was a Christian since 15. And, I mean, I believe that if you do believe the Bible, like, Jesus did say that those that would be looking for a sign will never find a sign. So I think people that look for signs are people that are never going to get signs. Like, the Christian faith is a faith-based religion like every other religion. So it's something accepted by faith. But I do believe that there is enough evidence to prove, like, the afterlife. And, like, two of the things that I bring out is to people, and I have dealt with atheists before, is, first of all, the paranormal, but specifically in the area of, like, near-death experiences, because I've studied near-death experiences mm-hmm. for years, and they date back clear into the 1960s, 70s. Mm-hmm. There's thousands and thousands of near-death experiences, and for all tens of thousands of near-death experiences, there's very, very similar things that are involved in it. So I doubt very seriously.
Let me check in, Rodney, because I hear you calling to say that you believe in, you know, the Christian God. That's your belief. You also say that you believe that it's possible to evidence that Christian God. Where's the evidence? Is what you're submitting here that because near-death experiences exist, God must also be a thing? Is that kind of where we're starting from here?
Not really, no.
Okay. Setting aside your beliefs, what is the evidence that you have that supports the notion that believing in God is a reasonable, rational thing to do?
I believe because of Jesus.
Okay.
Right. And so that's a belief.
I believe because of him and his life. And I do believe there is enough historical evidence to say that, I mean, for people to say that Jesus never existed is just purely right. absurd.
So you believe that it makes sense to believe in God because there is supernatural evidence, or because there's these near-death experiences, or because there's this historical evidence?
No.
What is a piece of evidence that we can look at?
I believe that there's enough evidence to believe in the Christian God mm-hmm. because of Jesus, but I do believe there's enough evidence to believe in an afterlife or a spiritual dimension because of not only, I'm not going to get into the paranormal because I've had friends that have personally experienced it. I won't get into that, but I'm particularly thinking of near-death experiences.
Okay. So,
which I have had friends personally involved with and tell me.
How did you eliminate?
They have no ulterior motive or anything like that.
You don't have to have
thousands of them.
Well, so how did you eliminate a purely natural cause for NDEs?
Purely natural cause?
Yeah, how did you eliminate a purely natural cause?
I don't doubt that some people that have had near-death experiences weren't, quote-unquote, dead to be able to experience a near-death experience. That's why I believe in the variety of them. Some people were probably close to death,
but that's
maybe nearly dead. But
that's not really an answer to the question, right? Because we could spend quite a bit of time talking about exactly what death is. I mean, medical, they have a definition, but people can't come back from that under the right conditions. So if they're super cold, things like that. What I'm asking specifically is, how did you eliminate natural causes, what you're claiming is a supernatural event?
Because of the events described that happen after they clinically have died, ruling out natural effect because they all say by like 90% or more of them, and I've read and studied thousands and thousands of near-death, so I have a lot of knowledge and near-death experiences, and I've had friends experience.
Right, but you understand that personal experience, even at that number, doesn't really mean anything to anybody, right? Because all it is a personal experience that we can't verify that experience in any way, shape, or form. And so what you need to do is to eliminate a natural cause. And given how much we don't know about biology and science and everything else around the world, I don't know how you eliminate a natural cause in a world where for the last 3,000 years, at least, we have been eliminating supernatural causes for almost everything in life. It just seems highly unlikely that everything from lightning to storms to disease have been shown to have natural causes when they were once thought supernatural. And all of a sudden, except for this one thing, NDEs, especially when we've done so much research, and in many cases, we can recreate some of those experiences through drugs. And so how did you eliminate the natural causes for anything given all of that? And is it possible to eliminate the natural causes?
Yes, you can eliminate the natural causes because like in 90% plus of near-death experiences, and like I said, I've read and studied thousands that date back from the 70s, 60s. I've had personal friends have it too. The fact that they all describe coming out of their body and floating and being able to see their body being worked on, and to describe things that there's no way, there's no natural explanation how they could.
So again, how do you know there's no natural way?
And hear things.
Show me how there's no natural way for them to know these things.
How could it be natural for somebody to claim to have come out of their body and go into other rooms of the hospital?
Hallucinations?
And hear, no.
Yeah.
You're kidding yourself with that. You can't have a hallucination that gives facts about what people said in other rooms. That's not a hallucination.
No, right. So if we have documented facts, that's a different thing, right? So that would be Jim's question. If you could give one example of like a very believable, certifiable example of somebody was in this room and they learned information from this other room, we could start to talk about that. But in each and every case, as you start to pull the threads...
We have that.
Right. I hear you saying you have that, but I asked you so many times to call in with just one piece of evidence, and you're talking in vague generalities. And so I'm going to talk in vague generalities and point out that for each of those vague generalities, as we start to pull the threads one by one, we start to see, well, maybe not everybody's lying. Maybe some people are being honest, but maybe they heard this in a different situation. Maybe they remembered it differently. I mean, consciousness is a very unreliable thing. Your brain is not a hard drive hooked up to a tape recorder and camcorder. The things that you think that you know should really be questioned. And if you want to talk about a specific example, we could maybe look at that particular example. It's hard to do in this format, I get it, but I really want to stress that these thousands of examples that supposedly exist out there just don't. If there was one, we wouldn't be talking about it on YouTube. It would be front page news.
There's many, hundreds of thousands of examples of this, where people have gone out of their bodies, have went to different rooms, have went actually to the top of the hospital and seen things on the top floor, the top roof of the hospital that was verified.
And those are the claims.
These things are in the hundreds of thousands
of claims.
Right. And we have, and the problem, part of the problem is that
documented claims, if you go and research,
I completely agree. The documented claims. And here's kind of where I come from. The best you can say about a near death experience is we don't know how it happened. Right. Because once you show me how, it's a phenomenon is either supernatural or natural, right? One of those two things. And if you're going to try and prove the negative, you have to eliminate all the natural, which you cannot do, right? Because there's so many different ways that people can do stuff. And so if you could, though, then you could say it was supernatural, but you can't do that. So the thing you need to do is you need to prove that it is, in fact, supernatural. And because we don't, but there's no way for, how do you prove that anything is supernatural? How do you eliminate somebody who overheard somebody describe what's on top of a hospital and then hallucinate that they floated up to that hospital and hallucinated the details? How do you eliminate that, given that a lot of times these patients are on drugs? They're on drugs that are slightly mind altering, right? How do you eliminate all that? And don't give me tens of thousands, because the number doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah, it does matter, because the more insurmountable evidence you have on something, the more it...
It's not insurmountable.
I mean, that's...
That's the problem. It's not insurmountable. What you have
is... When you study it, it is insurmountable. When you really study it, if you really look at them all...
Yeah, and I have. Really, and like I said, the best steel manning for your argument that I can give you is that we have phenomena we don't understand. And none of that proves it's supernatural, because you have to prove the supernatural exists first, and you can't do that. We haven't been able to do that. Every time somebody has tried, they have failed. You haven't proved it. All you've done was restated a bunch of claims that I have already said. The best I can give you is we have phenomena that are not understood. That is the best you can do. That's not proof. That's just, hey, we got a lot of stuff that we don't know. And yeah, it is interesting that some of this stuff happens and we don't know how it happens. But until we can conduct experiments and we can start eliminating variables, we don't know anything. And given the nature of the experience, it's really hard to do that. And that's not my problem. That's a you problem. That's your problem. You've got to figure out a way, or the people who, yes, because you got to figure out a way to eliminate all the possible variables to just one and figure out what the mechanism is. Because it doesn't happen every time, right? It doesn't happen every time somebody has, not everybody who dies and comes back has a near-death experience. Some of them experience nothing. How do you explain that?
Like I just told you, some people don't actually get to the point where their soul leaves their body.
If they're pronounced dead and then somehow they come back, then how do you know their soul didn't leave their body? How do you know there's a soul?
How do I know there's a soul? Because like I told you, near-death experiences.
So again, we keep coming back to the same thing. You have no explanation.
Go ahead.
You have no explanation. Uh-huh. You can't prove that there's a soul, right? Because we know how neurons work. And guess what? There's no place in the neural circuitry of the brain for a soul to plug into. Just none. So there's no place for a soul, as far as we can tell. And so if you're going to say the soul leaves the body, you need to first prove there's a soul. You haven't done that. So you can't say the soul leaves the body and have us accept that, because you haven't proven it. And we could actually show that there's no room for a soul in the way we know the brains work so far, to our best understanding of science.
So the testimony of thousands and thousands of people are just considered nothing.
No, they're considered testimony of something we don't understand. And you're willing, see, here's part of the difference. I'm saying there's something here that I don't know and science can't explain. And I'm leaving it at that. Uh-huh. You're going a step further. You're saying we don't know, therefore supernatural and God. You're taking a step further that you just can't, you can't take that step. Sometimes you have to stop with I don't know.
Because 90 whatever percent of all near-death experiences will describe meeting God or angelic beings or past relatives.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to let you have that number and not push back on that statistic too hard, but it's also not terribly true, right? If we start looking at people in different cultures who grew up believing in a different God, if we start looking historically at people at various times, this notion that there is this like very American Christianity, pearly gates with somebody outside of it and cherubs and all these things that aren't even in the Bible is pretty ridiculous, because when we start looking cross-culturally, it just doesn't hold up.
Mm-hmm. That's not true. That means you haven't studied, because I have. I'll take your word for it.
I have not read 10,000 of near-death experiences, but I have asked a concrete series of questions, and I don't feel like we're getting any closer to an answer to any of those questions.
Yeah, and you restating there are tens of thousands doesn't mean anything, because none of those have actually been an experiment. All of those are reports from people. And if you go and you look at the reliability of eyewitness testimony, you'll find it's the most unreliable evidence presented to in a court of law. Eyewitness testimony is not reliable. And there's a number of reasons for it. Okay. And so you have to eliminate all those. And it's just an impossible thing, because most of those reports are just retelling of what happened. There's no attempt to provide explanation on any of those reports. And that's what we need, is an attempt to provide an explanation. You can't just say, I don't know, therefore the supernatural.
I can.
Okay. Congratulations. You haven't convinced us. And I hope you have a wonderful Sunday. Talk to you later. Thanks
for
calling.
Try again. Tell us when you can.
Yeah.
All right. Where you want to go?
Let's see. You want to go to that one?
If you do.
All right, here we go. Gohan in Texas, as soon as I push the button and all the magic. There we go. All right, Gohan, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Just fine.
I was going to talk about an argument I heard regarding abortion.
Okay.
Regarding specifically bodily autonomy.
Uh-huh.
Before I get into the argument, can I just understand where you guys are coming from? Do you both kind of deny that a human fetus is a person?
No, I don't. I don't know about
Christian. I mean, it kind of depends on, quote, where you draw that line. What is personhood? How have we defined personhood? Like, we can get into that, but if we're going to talk about bodily autonomy, let's just talk about bodily autonomy, because as I think Jim's already alluding to, the question of personhood doesn't really matter here.
No, I don't need a fetus to be a person or not for the bodily autonomy argument to work. In fact, it works better with a fetus as a human being, I think. But other people are free to disagree, and we'll have beers over it sometime.
No, that's why I want to ask first, just so we can, at least for the sake of argument, doesn't mean you truly think a fetus is a person, but just for the sake of argument, we're assuming it's a person for this argument. Is that fair?
Sure.
Okay. So it's a question I've heard a lot, but it's kind of saying that by banning abortion, we are giving more rights to a fetus than any other human.
Mm-hmm.
Question.
That's correct.
When is there a time where you can force somebody else to use their body for somebody else?
When is slavery appropriate? So the question you just asked me was, when is slavery appropriate?
Sorry?
You just asked me, the equivalent of what you just asked me is, when is slavery appropriate? That's the question you just asked.
I'd appreciate if we could stick to the words. If you want to go slavery, I'm okay with doing that. But,
no, I'm saying if you do not have bodily autonomy, you are a slave.
Do you believe bodily autonomy is absolute?
To an extent, yes. There are, I mean, we can get into whether prisons are bodily autonomy violations or not and things like that. But for the most part, yes, bodily autonomy is pretty absolute because of the severity of losing your ability to control your own body.
So when those instances where it's not absolute arise, is that slavery to you?
It is a form of slavery, yes.
So you think it should be absolute, you just say right now it's not.
I'm saying that because we are limited beings, we do not. Sometimes we have to choose the lesser of two evils.
And I mean, there are definitely circumstances where people are not able to manage their own care, where perhaps they're not able to consent to anything. And so their ability to take care of themselves, can we override that? I mean, that's very, very tricky. Like, I've worked in crisis mental health for a number of years, and it's very uncomfortable to look at the way our legal system deals with the autonomy of some of these folks. Again, it's difficult to know exactly where to draw some of the lines, but can we get to the crux of your argument?
I just want to reply really quick, and then we can get to the crux of the argument. But according to Mr. Burrow, I think I said your name correctly, you're saying that when bodily autonomy is not followed, is akin to slavery. There are some instances where you say bodily autonomy should not be held up. Are you saying that it's okay to have slavery in that instance, or do you want to change the phrase?
No, it's so there are times where you have to choose the lesser of two evils, but you should never ever lose fact of the fact that you are still choosing evil, even though it's the lesser of two evils. So in the case where somebody is unable to control their body and acts in a violent way, we are okay. I am okay with saying to that person, we need to restrict your ability to hurt other people. Now, is that actually bodily autonomy? Is that other things we can argue that? Let's just leave it. It is bodily autonomy. In that particular case, okay, we are choosing the lesser of two evils, where one person is uncontrollably hurting other people and then controlling that person to prevent that from happening. Is that still evil? Yes. Is that the lesser of the two evils? Yes. But we always have to remember, whenever we're choosing the lesser of two evils, we are still choosing evil. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So I guess I'll get into the crux of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
I do have an instance where it would be, at least I believe, okay to prevent or take away somebody's bodily autonomy in order to help another human being.
No.
No, sorry, I'm saying I have this belief.
Okay, sure.
And you might as well, after I go through this example, it's a common pro-life example called Cabin in the Woods. Pretty much, it's a mom of an infant who goes into the woods, into a cabin. All of a sudden, there's an avalanche. There's plenty of food for the mom to survive. Let's say for some reason, it doesn't matter what reason, she does not want to feed her infant, who can only eat off of breast milk at the moment. Should she be forced to use her body against her will to feed that other human? I would say yes.
No,
no.
What do you say?
No, because you're forcing somebody to sacrifice themselves for somebody else, and I don't think that is a good thing to do.
You're using a person as a means to an end rather than an end unto themselves. And that's always going to be ethically problematic, if not just outright unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could acknowledge that you guys don't agree with that, but I do,
sure,
then we could also acknowledge that I'm not fighting for rights for a fetus that I believe no other human has. I believe that infant has the same right as the fetus. So can we agree that I don't think that fetus has more rights than that infant based off bodily autonomy?
So there are so many, I mean, you're talking about so many different things. So for instance, with a fetus, one of the problems you have is before they're born is that this is going to cause permanent changes to a woman's body. 10%, that's the wrong statistic. A woman who's pregnant always risks her life as well as the infants, right? So there are things that happen that are beyond just, say, feeding and life support, and reducing women to life support is problematic in itself. But anyway, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, if you want to get into yes, one might be a little bit more risky than the other, we have to talk about how high is that risk and at what point is it okay to kill another human or another person.
I don't get to make that decision for anybody else but me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get to choose the risk level for anybody but me.
I think you do. I think if that human was a five-year-old, you would choose a risk level is appropriate in order.
No.
So you're saying that it's not up to you if somebody else chooses to kill a five-year-old?
Oh, it's up to me to choose to interfere with that, right? And it's up to me to choose how much risk level I'm willing to take to do that, right? So if somebody has got a flamethrower and I got to get in between the flamethrower and the five-year-old, I'm not required to do that. I may not be willing to risk that at that point for somebody else. So that is entirely up to me. Nobody has any right to tell somebody else to risk their lives.
I mean,
save a life. You're just forced to not end a life. So it's kind of like in Batman, at the end, he's facing Ra's al Ghul and saying, I'm not going to kill you. I'm just not going to save you.
That woman should not be forced to feed the infant. Do I think it's the right thing to do? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can, feed somebody. But, you know, if we carry that far enough, like, why are any of us having this conversation rather than volunteering at a food bank, right? We can talk about how much you're able to give and what's the right amount for you to give and everything else. And I do think we have a moral responsibility to one another. But I don't think we have an ethical right to come in and tell other people how much of their own bodies they are meant to contribute.
Can I respond to that really quick?
Hit me.
So I think that's a fair point. I think the difference between Ra's al Ghul and the infant in the Cabin in the Woods scenario is the infant is the child of the mother, still a child, still dependent on the mother.
Yep.
Ra's al Ghul.
So if it was an orphan that she picked up along the way, her moral responsibility changes?
It's not her responsibility to take care of an orphan. It is her responsibility to take care of her child.
No, it is not her responsibility to necessarily do that if she doesn't want it. Because again, you're forcing someone else to do something again. And this is
every parent has the responsibility to take care of their child.
No,
if until somebody else can do it.
No,
in this scenario, they're abandoned in the cabin in the woods. There's nobody else there.
And that's fine. And she can choose to do that or not. And there's no moral obligation for her to do that.
You can refuse to live your feed your child. That's your stance.
Yes, a person can refuse to feed their child, yes. And there is nothing we can do to force it.
Yeah, well, we can. We can pass laws to make it forceful to feed and raise your kid.
We can take the kid away.
Yeah, we can take
the kid away. We don't, right. I mean, trying to force a parent to feed, you can't force a parent to feed a child unless you're willing to put a cop in the house with the mother and the child. It's just not possible. But you can take the child away and give it to somebody who is willing to take care of the child.
If a child starves to death, then that's okay.
I didn't say that.
Nobody said anything is right or good. Yeah,
wow.
We don't want any dead kids, really. I mean, generally speaking, that's kind of the philosophy.
And do it again, and I'm just going to cut you off, all right? Don't put words in our mouth and don't say things we didn't say, or I will just simply drop
you. Maybe okay is not the right word, but is it morally permissible to let a child starve?
No, it's not morally permissible to force somebody else to feed that child. There's a difference.
So why is it okay to let the child starve in the cabin in the woods, but it's not okay to let a child starve out
because
here?
Because it's not society allowing the child to starve. It's a mother choosing to do that, and then we can't force the choice. As a society, we can choose to pick up the slack.
We're allowing the mother to let the child starve,
yes,
correct?
In that case, yes, because there's no society to step in and help. There's nobody else around.
So in one case, so if I can say your point fairly, if there's nobody else around, if it's up to the mom only, if she's the only one who can do it, it's okay to let the child starve. But if the child is not with the mom alone, not in like an abandoned woods scenario, then it's not okay because society can step in.
I think maybe we'll understand each other better if we're talking about like whose chair are you sitting in, right? Like I'm not going to advocate for that woman not feeding her child. It's wrong to let somebody starve if you have the ability to step in. I don't know that exact scenario. I don't know the situation. I don't know if it's even like practical or realistic or possible for her to step in. But if you have the opportunity to rescue a child from dying, I think you, quote, should do it. Do I think that society, the government, or anybody else has the right to say, no, you must use your body in this way? No, that anytime we're making that rule, we're getting into trouble. So yes, feed your babies, take care of one another, be kind to everybody as best you can. But that doesn't mean that we as a society can create a ethical maxim that forces anybody to do anything with their body.
Okay, so I'm going to try to phrase it fairly. You guys are against forcing the mom to prevent her kid from starving in the cabin in the woods. But every other scenario, you are in favor of like forcing parents to feed their children.
No, we're not in favor of anybody forcing another human being to do anything they don't want to do, except when we're choosing the lesser of two evils.
Okay, so when is it okay to force a parent to feed their children? Never or sometimes?
As long as there's a society to pick up the slack, never. And if there's a society to protect, to pick up, and if there's a society to force a parent to do something they don't want to, there is a society who can pick up the slack on that.
Okay, so if there is not a society to do that, then it's okay to allow it.
I don't know that it's okay, but that's what's going to happen.
Sorry, not okay. More
yeah, if there's no society, how are we allowing? I think we're starting to get a little bit off the rails, and that's okay because we've been pulling at this and tugging at all the different threads. It keeps coming back to you can't make other people do things with their body that they don't want to do. That's just how it works out.
Right.
I mean, I think clearly, I think there is. I think parents have a duty to their children. And until someone else can step in and take the role of parenting, they have to fulfill that duty. If society can do it, that's great. But if not, it's still their duty right. to...
And you're pro-slavery. You're yeah. pro-making parents slaves to their kids.
I thought you said we weren't going to put words in each other's mouths, Mr.
That, that's the effect of what you're doing, right? Because as soon as... this is the crux of the problem. When you force somebody to use their body in a way they don't want to, you're forcing them to be a slave. There is no difference between those two situations. There's no difference between a society saying you must feed your kids and saying you must go harvest that cotton. No difference whatsoever.
Right. You must put on clothes when in public. That's slavery as well. You must have your body clothed in public. Is that slavery?
Yeah, I would say that is a definite form of slavery, with forcing people to do that. I have no problem with people walking around nude if they want to. That's entirely a puritanical Christian problem.
I think that muddles down the word of slavery, and it's an insult to everyone who was a slave when you say that is slavery.
That's very nice, but it doesn't change the fact that it is. As soon as, because there's no difference between society telling a person they have to wear clothes and a society telling a person they have to go and harvest cotton. There's no difference.
I think there's a very big difference between those two.
That's nice, but what's the difference?
One is for the protection of others, specifically kids. The other is
How is nudity dangerous?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, if my 5-year-old sees a naked woman, and then he would start to ask questions, and then maybe he would start to try.
Oh, please, don't ask questions. Oh, my God, no, we can't ask questions. Oh, wait, you're part of a religion that thinks that the first sin was eating the apple from the tree of fruit
and all. Wait, did you hear the last part of that?
No.
Where he had sex at age 10 because he saw a naked woman. Is that okay for
you? Is that how that happens, though, Gohan? I mean, you called in with a well-thought-out plan, and we wanted to talk about it. We talked about it. Now we are just so far away. The notion that your 5-year-old will have sex at 10 because he saw a naked lady just ignores everything we know about 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds, about sex, about nudity, about the many, many, many cultures all around the world where nudity is commonplace. I mean, this is getting a little ridiculous. I appreciate your basic notion. You called in with a good, interesting question, and I feel like we answered it pretty adequately. And maybe if you want to play with that, sit with that a little bit and give us another try, yeah?
I think you guys did answer it fairly well. If I could just try to sum up the call, because we did get off track a little bit. I'm saying that a fetus and an infant have the same rights because I can force a mom to breastfeed in a cabin in the woods. You guys are saying I can't do that, so therefore they don't have the same rights, and a fetus has more rights than the infant. Is that fairly
summarized? Yes. I mean, the mechanism of forcing a woman to breastfeed in the woods is kind of begging the question, what does any of it even really mean? I think we can more so boil it down to, is it okay to force somebody else to do something with their body? And we both say no.
Okay. So I think I summarized it fairly well. I think you guys answered the question fairly well.
Cool.
Okay. Yeah.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks for the call, y'all.
Right, yeah. Thanks. Bye. That went better than expected. Okay. We got an audience question.
Yeah, let's talk to some question. Folks out in the crowd. Who y'all got for us?
Hey, it's Andrew.
Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Andrew.
Just figured I'd ask a question about the, I guess, more recent apologetics for primarily for Christianity, but I'm sure it applies to pretty much every monotheism. But why is it that they feel like the likes of William Lane Craig and Frank Turek, or just two that I know for sure, that run this... philosophical argument about just the possibility of a deistic God, and then think that's sufficient to bring themselves to the eventuality of their particular God. Why do they find that to be sufficient?
That's actually not new. There's no new
apologetic
questions anymore. They're all about 100 years old. William Lane Craig did put lipstick on a pig, but that's about all he's really done with that. I don't know, because they're trying to get to a point where you can admit that there's this, and then they can start building on it. So if you can admit to a deistic God, then they can build to their God, which is what William Lane Craig does with the Kalam argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
is the long argument is three sentences, and then he all of a sudden we get to God. Right. And God's not mentioned anywhere else of those things. Neither are any of the qualities that he says God has. And so that's basically what they're trying to do. It's the same tactic, right? If they can get you to admit to the possibility of a deistic God, and then they're one step closer to getting to their version of a God. That's all it is. It's a stepping stone.
If I just find it odd that even some atheists give those types of arguments credence.
Well, the deistic God is the hardest to talk about because he has no qualities and he has no interactions with the universe, and therefore he is effectively the same thing as nothing, as no God at all, right? And so how do you talk about a God like that? We can't say that God has blue eyes. We can't say that God has eyes or has any sensory apparatus whatsoever. That God is, as I said, indistinguishable from nothing. So how do we talk about him?
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, so if they can get there, then they will try and stair-step their way to their God, who actually has things that we can start talking about, right? Is the God omnibenevolent? Well, we can look around the world and go, no, that's not possible, right? Because there are things we're doing right now. We look at disease, and if you want to say disease is evil, we're getting rid of disease. We're getting rid of that as every chance we get, right? We've gotten rid of smallpox, and we got rid of, we almost got rid of polio. It's back, apparently. But we can look at diseases. We can look at, we're in an air-conditioned building, and it's hot and humid outside, and we're not hot and humid. Well, you guys aren't. We're a little hot in here. we don't have any AC or much AC in here right now. And so everything that we do, we are actively making our world better. And an omnibenevolent God, who's also omnipotent, should have already done that. We shouldn't live on a planet that, 70% of it will kill us. Salt water and all the rest of that. So, yeah, it's just stair-stepping. They're just trying to get you to agree to something. And that's why you have to be careful when they start this questioning approach, is because they're building on your acceptance of certain things without you really critically thinking about how you're going to respond to it. And so that's also part of the trap that they're laying with a questioning type of conversation. And that's very different than straight epistemology, which is asking open-ended questions, not questions you want them, you're trying to get them, lead them down.
Lead an answer, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and not for nothing, but if we can tie a deistic notion of God to the Christian God, then all of a sudden, all of our nationalistic fervor around the founding fathers and the original intent of the Constitution and all of that starts to fall apart. So I think that there's a meaningful temptation from a lot of folks to try and make deism synonymous with Christianity, which of course it isn't.
It isn't, yeah.
But by drawing that comparison over and over and over, all of a sudden, Benjamin Franklin switching sides. And, so much of our understanding of America starts to shift in some very specific ways.
I guess just a short follow-up to that is I noticed that there hasn't ever been an actual argument as to why God would be good.
Yeah.
It's always just asserted.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Another thing that I think the only argument that I can remember offhand is William Lane Craig saying that God has to be worthy of worship. But I mean, I don't see why they couldn't just be a conquering God that was just all powerful and could just as well be evil and right. be worth worship to some.
Yeah. That word worthy, I mean, right. all of it is, it's just a house of cards. It's just random things sort of plucked from the zeitgeist that we would really like to be true, or some of us would really like to be true, and then trying to stack it up.
Yeah,
fair enough. That's it. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, glad to hear from you.
Yeah. And then some of you, if you shop on Amazon, you can support the ACA at no cost to you. Simply visit tiny.cc/AmazonSmileCA and designate the Atheist Community of Austin as your selected charity, and Amazon will donate a portion of their profit directly to the ACA. We now have a channel that houses all of the shows on the ACA in audio podcast form. Visit tiny.cc/AENpodcasts. There you can listen to all the latest shows from The Atheist Experience, Talk Heathen, Truth Wanted, and Secular Sexuality. The nonprofits and others are on one channel. We also have three Facebook groups that are run by fans for fans that you can interact with. The first is the Atheist Experience fan group at tiny.cc/FBAXP. There's also the Atheist Experience private fan group where you can interact with others without having those interactions appear on your public feed at tiny.cc/FBAXPPR. We also have a brand new group, the Atheist Experience Fan Group, Atheist vs. Theist Debates, where you can try out some of your arguments on theists and atheists alike. You can find that at tiny.cc/AXPFanDebates. All right. Paying the bills, and then on to this one?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So I'm probably going to butcher this name. Vaclav.
Yes.
The Czech Republic. Did I pronounce your name correctly? Vaclav, is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You sound like somebody.
Sounds like a no, but yeah. We appreciate you giving us a little bit of grace on that.
Sound like somebody who's spoken to too many Americans, getting your name wrong, and I apologize for that. How do you pronounce it?
No. It's okay, and I want to apologize for my language skills too. So
it's okay. We'll do our best. So, what do you want to talk about today?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Well, I'm atheist, but I used to be atheist, and it's not as long ago as I wish to be. And I want to discuss with one of the, let's say, proofs or arguments which used to convince me back then about historicity of Jesus and reliability of New Testament and so on. Well, it's actually this proof. It wasn't for me. It's from one of our theologians and psychologists, and he claimed that there are the psychological proofs that the Jesus was first the real person, then he was really adopted child, and that the Bible is the reliable source because the writers of the Bible they depicted some things as he claims the psychological things which according to him was unknown. For example, that Jesus has the conflict with his own family because he was of course adopted and everybody in that days know it, that he wasn't the Joseph's son. And he also claimed that another thing is that he sided with the outcast and miserable people. He promoted the adoption in the New Testament and so on. He also claimed that Jesus was actually the real man. In that mean, he wasn't some kind of avatar, but he was the real man with everything, even with the flaws. But he evolved during the New Testament to some kind of the true Son of God.
Right. No, those are all the claims.
It's a lot of claims.
It's a lot of claims. It needs a lot of evidence to back up, especially the supernatural element. We can accept that there was, in fact, one or more people that the Jesus legend was built on. But when you look at something like what QAnon has done, QAnon is at most 2 years old, and there is a whole stack of legend that goes with being a QAnon person. And so for legends to develop very quickly is very obvious. And this is also, you go back and look at Elvis. There were Elvis sightings the day after his funeral. I think there were Elvis sightings before his funeral, actually.
Sure.
But yeah, so you could look at all this legend stuff and go, someone can go out and preach and build a following, and then legends can build on that. And that's really all that you have is legends. That's without getting into how many of the gospels are actually just direct word for word copies with stuff added to them. And all of this other stuff that if you go and listen to and talk to Bible scholars about, all of a sudden you find out all this really, really interesting stuff. Like there's a lot of synchronization, a lot of borrowing of other ideas from other religions that are brought into the New Testament. There's a couple of scholars who point out a lot of the Greek influences, the Greek God influences on the story. But you don't have to go and do any of that and listen to that. There's a couple of good channels on YouTube that do that as well. MythVision is one of them, and there's others that really get into the history and where the Bible comes from as well as other myths. Without any of that, just looking and go, that is all claims, right? If you want to claim Jesus turned water into wine, I don't have the equipment. We should really get that trick in here so we can do it on live.
What trick?
Yeah, you can go and buy that trick online. It's a child's magic trick toy where you can do water into wine. or water into Coke or whatever else you want. It's not hard to do. Almost all the miracles that I'm aware of that Jesus has claimed to have done is nothing can be done with sleight of hand. There's nothing miraculous about it.
Or not done and written down.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's enough. But Vaclav, I don't want to get too far from your central question, which if you'll help me out, I'm a little bit unclear on.
Well, I just thinking now, if this argument was, or this claims, if it were sound, and if it was reasonable back then to build my faith on it. Now, I'm studying psychology myself in master degree, and I can say, even without any knowledge of Bible, that it's a little bit, let's say, unstable to back up all of these claims just from one document or four documents which were heavily copied and inspired by each other, and which we even don't know how the authors meant or what they wanted to tell us. So as some kind of psychological study, because we can use, of course, some documents and make the case study on this, but these documents must be reliable pictures of reality, like photos and from different sources and so on.
I would say that in terms of reliability, the earliest documents we have are about a century old. And some of those are credit card sized. They're not very big at all. And we don't really start seeing a plethora of sources until we get into the second century. Before that, what you have is the telephone game being played with stories on a very wide scale. And you can't put anything reliable in it. Are you familiar with the telephone game? You may call it something different, but are you familiar with the telephone game?
Yes, of course. We call it, of course, differently, but the principle is that we have the tendency to change the stories in oral tradition to level it up or somehow modify it, and it's natural process.
Right.
But to be honest, I deconstruct my, say, childish views on religions and what I believed, but still I have some problem with the people like this who are making very very thoughtful assumptions about Bible, about God, natural theology, or in this case, in the New Testament. But in the end, all of their claims are, well, let's say, well, just claims without any evidence. I just asking myself why they are invest so much energy in these things.
Yeah, I mean the world is dark and full of terrors, right? Like we're all looking for a story to tell ourselves to try and make life and the universe make sense. And so a lot of times we will take on faith or grapple or grab things that don't really make any sense when we break it down. And then when we form a society around those ideas, they get shoved down your throat. So it's not unreasonable or difficult to appreciate why people would bend themselves into pretzels to believe these things. But once you recognize that you're doing that, you have to take a step back and try to find a way to do life that just feels a little bit more reasonable, a little more straightforward.
And are you familiar are you familiar with the backfire effect?
Not clearly.
Most people, when you directly oppose a deeply held belief, even with facts and logic, they will dig in harder and believe more than they did before after the end of the conversation. And so they will come up with more and more reasons to justify what they believe, right? It's similar to the sales principle of people buy on emotion and justify on logic. It's similar to that. But a lot of it is when you, and this is why we have to be careful when we're talking with theists, to not directly confront them with facts, because we're actually shooting ourselves in the foot for a lot of folks, because they will simply dig in harder. But some of what you're talking about is probably just the backfire effect.
Well, maybe because when I usually watching the clever men's, clever theists,
they usually tend to make the whole new religion for themselves to sustain their own theism. This is actually, the same case what I presented here, because this man, this doctor, he claims that he cannot believe just what it's presented to him in catechism and in traditional mm-hmm. beliefs, so he need to make these more sophisticated things, which are still the theology mm-hmm. in many ways, but it sounds more scientifically, so it's more acceptable.
Well, remember, a large part of science is testing things, right? So it can sound more scientific, but if they're not actually showing you the results of tests and how they eliminated variables so that it's a single variable being tested at a time, it's not really science. It sounds like science, but unless there's something to test or to falsify in particular, because that's what we're looking for, is falsifications mm-hmm. over, and we want to prove something false rather than something true. And if we fail, then we might be onto something there in terms of science. But yeah, that is pretty much what it is people believe. They grew up believing, they think they're right, and they want to hold on to that feeling, and they don't want to be wrong, because we don't like being wrong. I don't know about the education system in the Czech Republic, but I know here in the United States, people fail for being wrong. And in life, we don't fail for being wrong, we just learn and move on. So I think those are all good points that you brought up.
Yes, actually, thank you. And this is the same with the second part of question. What bugged me now is that the natural theology, and what I noticed is that this natural theologian mostly insists that we don't need just scientific evidence, because we can use just our logical and our reasoning, and it's somehow higher, and the metaphysical is better than actual physics. And so we can use these things even when it's sometimes just, making thoughts from the air.
Yeah, I mean, the metaphysical is always more important to than the physical, until the physical literally slaps you in your actual face. Right? Like, we can play around with these different models, and there's a curiosity to it, and a certain beauty and elegance to it. But we want to be able to tie these things to actual facts that can be measured and seen and weighed. And I think it's important to maintain that level of materialism when we're talking about capital S science, which is what we're trying to describe here.
Well, definitely. But I'm sorry, but this is just my personal lamentation, because I am sometimes see that in my own subject, I mean in psychology, there are a lot of theists who are tending to use their theistical view in, for example, in a psychological approach, which sometimes I think it's quite harmful.
Yeah.
There are even some things like the hagiotherapy, which is used in, I don't know if it's in America, but in Czech Republic, it's using the Bible as the therapeutic approach. Mm-hmm. And I think that this could be very harmful. For example, in the if you are working with the people with the mental illnesses and so on.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely a problem here in the States too, of people putting the Bible over science in psychology. So I know.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate what you called for. I want to make sure that you got what you were looking for. Before we let you go and wrap everything up, was there like one specific question that we might be able to take a shot at? I want to make sure that we got to the crux of what you were looking to discuss today.
Well, I think that there's not, because I just have this bugle with this questions like philosophy and this claims, which I think it's actually a good sign, because if I think that if I'm thinking about this thing, that it's mean that I'm let's say out of the theism.
Yeah, I can't quite say that I'm following. Jim, are you with me here?
I didn't quite follow either.
So we're just about to let the call go. We do really appreciate hearing from you. Do you want to take one more quick stab at that? I mean, can you give me one sentence or less to make sure that we got to everything that you wanted to talk to today?
Maybe I think it's all okay.
Okay.
Thank you guys.
Appreciate you
for your time.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Have a great day.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. And, you know, we've got a bunch of shows other than The Atheist Experience that you're currently watching, such as Secular Sexuality, The Nonprofits, Truth Wanted, and Talk Heathen. And if you didn't catch any of those shows, here's a taste of the things you probably want to go back and watch.
Maybe I'll use that phrase a lot, but it's important to stress you're normal. Whatever it is, no matter how it hangs or dangles or smells or whatever else, it's normal. It's beautiful.
He goes to heaven and he gets to live forever, whereas Anne Frank, who never came to understand Christ as her Lord and personal Savior, burns forever in a fire. Is that perfect justice? Because if it is, perfect justice can go
Feel free to give me some praise hands, ladies.
For whatsoever thy soul lusteth after, for sheep or wine, or for strong drink, thou shalt eat there before the Lord thy God.
So there you
Amen.
Have it, folks.
Amen.
The Bible says grass and beer.
Atheists go to outer darkness. It's a place worse than hell.
Frank, why on earth should anybody believe that this is a real place?
Kenneth, you're going to go to Valhalla when you die.
I'd like to go to Cancun or something.
Way cooler.
But really, very polite, well-groomed people are gathering in temples as we speak. With all of their kids, and they believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet. What happens if you get to heaven and heaven is full of Mormons?
Alrighty, and so it is. I think that was proof that it's always Thursday.
Yeah, it's always Thursday somewhere, or whatever it is that the crew says. but we like to have a good, sexy time on Secular Sexuality, and that's the vibe I try to take out into the world.
Well, it sounded like Nonprofits had that vibe going on there.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right, well, we've got a person in the studio who wants to ask us a question. Larry, I think you're in Austin. Go ahead.
Yes, I am from the Austin area. I am an atheist, and as you can see, and I've been a lot more open about that atheism with the people around me in the last year or so. And one of the more annoying things is that they tell me, well, that's just like a religion. You're always involved with them on Sunday or whatever. And so I just wondered what's a good way to answer that?
Maybe ask them back. So you think that being a religion is nothing more than having something to do on a Sunday? Wow.
Yeah. I mean, if I join a bowling club and we're doing basically all of those same fundamental things, is it a, quote, religion? What is a religion? Do I want to not be a religion? I don't care. Like, if somebody's trying to just give you a gotcha question and be a jerk about it, you can tell them to fuck off. But, I mean, if somebody sincerely wants to talk to you about these kinds of things, then that's fine. But what is a religion? Is a religion, quote, inherently bad? I don't necessarily know the answers to those questions. I just know that, you know, I try to believe as many true things as possible. I try to debunk as many untrue things as possible. Can we leave it at that?
It is annoying, though.
Yeah, it is annoying. Fair, fair. Yeah. I mean, nobody, aside from snide jokes, people aren't making those same comments about folks who are going to, you know, the local Steelers bar every Sunday to join with their crew wearing the Steelers colors, talking about Steelers football and all of these kinds of things. That's not a quote, religion. So what makes a religion? I don't know. You're right, Larry. I hear it all the time. It's a little bit of obnoxious, but people are a little bit obnoxious.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I think you've given me some ideas about how to counter some of that.
Fair enough.
Depends on how snarky you want to be, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
you can get really
that's kind of what
it
comes down to. Who are you talking to?
Yeah. Sounds like if all you're doing is going to the same place on a Sunday and have something that you like to do on a Sunday, mm-hmm. that's the extent of what you call a religion. I'm not sure your faith is smaller than a mustard seed.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Yep. Okay. Do we have another one, or are we going back to calls? I'm asking the people in my ear.
All right.
Oh, we have another one.
Back all to right. the studio oh, no. audience. We appreciate y'all so much for coming here.
This is Nancy from Texas.
Hi. How are you?
Not sure yet.
I'm going to ask something serious, I promise.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were talking earlier, and this is kind of what y'all were mentioning, I think, on the show previously, when you said that Austin was an oasis of blue in a sea of red. And we talked about that in the back after between shows and stuff. And I'm wondering if everybody who's different leaves the Sea of Red, which is where I live. I live in the Bible Belt, and they don't stay. How does that change?
Yeah, I mean, Austin is very much a beacon city, like in particular for the queer community. I mean, if you look at just how vibrant the burlesque scene is, the, you know, all of these different like very queer events here in Austin, this is the place. I mean, myself included, I grew up just an hour from here in the shadow of the bright lights of the big city, wishing for a safe place to be. And on a certain sense, it's like every election cycle we hear about, oh, well, if this happens, I'm moving to Canada. And that kind of always goes on. But I hear the fear, because it does feel like recently it's gone from people griping, people claiming that they're going to leave, to me having many personal friends and acquaintances and coworkers and people in my life who are packing up their shit and leaving because they're terrified of our governor. They're terrified of our governance in general. Where does all that lead? I mean, I don't know, Jim. What do you feel?
I feel the same way. I dug in because that's my home. I'm born and raised there. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to leave, because if I leave, who takes up the fight?
Right.
So I wasn't going to do that. But now I'm just like, I'm only going to get one life, and I don't know that I want to fight anymore. I want to go and enjoy it. I fought for 40 years, you know, while everybody else left. Every gay friend I had left, every trans friend I had left, every atheist friend I had left, because they didn't want to stay and fight. And I'm like, our community would be different if they hadn't left.
Well,
that's true.
So I tend to blame both sides because of it.
Yeah. I think the problem is that, you know, Kirstie and I have made a choice, and all the hosts on all the shows have made a choice to be out and in the fight. And that is not a choice everybody wants to make. Not everybody wants to do that. It's up to each individual to choose what they're willing to risk and what they're willing to put up with. You know, if you're a gay person out in East Texas, how you can stay there and fight, but how do you have a life? How do you have a partner? How do you find?
That's true.
How do you get traction on the fight that you're fighting?
But it is possible, because I know some who do, but it's rare. Right.
They're gonna end up being queer people everywhere. We're making more every single day, and so it's inevitable that not everybody can run away from the thing that they want to run away from. It basically boils down to, what do we owe each other? I mean, right. Jim, in the time you and I have been doing this, how many really wonderful, dedicated, hardworking, committed activists have we seen either burn out or move on or just finish their time? And yet you have to make space for that. You have to make space for that, not just in this type of like organized activism, but even in the day-to-day thing of, you know, not feeling safe when you need to pull over to go to the bathroom somewhere, not feeling safe walking into a grocery store or a hardware store or wherever else. We should all fight for representation. We should all fight for our right to take up space. But I think we also have permission to lay down arms and, I don't know, what's the fantasy? Move to Canada every once in a while?
South Pacific.
There's room for that. Yeah. Cancun. Yeah, no, I guess I want to die and or retire and move to Cancun.
Right. And I think, too, you know, as more and more people move out because of the diehards that are left, they self-isolate and they eventually go away, and other people will move in because property gets cheap because they've gone away. And so you may end up with people moving back for those reasons. But I don't think there's a good answer to that, because we can't force people to make a choice to stay and fight when they don't want to, when they feel their lives are on the line. And there was a time when that wasn't the case. You know, I went to high school in Abilene, Texas. It's just a couple hours west of us, right? And the acceptance of the gay community was begrudgingly there. I won't say that it was enthusiastic by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't know of any gay people who were truly afraid of being shot and killed on a daily basis like I think they do today. Did they want to get caught anywhere near the football team? No. So there was still a little threat of violence there, but it's not like it was today. And I don't think
I feel the same way. I think it's more present. And that's my consideration, too, because I'm now to the point where I'm like, I don't see it improving. And I want to go, too, because why should I spend the next 40 years doing what I've done this 40 years?
Right.
It's how much do you give it?
Yeah. And that's the question for everybody. You can give as much as you can, however you can. You know, that goes back to the things we ask of our viewers, like and subscribe. But, you know, if you decide not to because you realize that YouTube is tracking that and you don't want that to happen, I don't blame you. I don't blame you in this environment at all. Same thing with a lot of things. If you decide not to do certain things because you have, I think there's legitimate fear everywhere. And so, yeah, I think that because of that, because people are tired, there are people in the LGBTQ community who have been fighting this fight since the 70s. And before, I mean, there are people before that. I'm saying they were born in the 60s and then the 70s and the 80s. And now look where we are today. And we've taken these huge steps backward. Yeah. And for all those people, I'm just like, you're still in the fight. You are absolutely amazing. And you're far stronger than I am because I'm sure at that same point, right? Ready to kick in that towel. Yeah. And so we need to make sure that those people recognize that they are appreciated by a few of us, at the very least, some of those old dogs in this fight, and make sure that the new dogs are getting, you know, what they want. Never, ever underestimate the power of a healer, of someone who is just willing to give somebody water and to just say, hey, that was a good job, and we'll get, you know, to the cheerleaders and the people in the background you never see. You know, for us, that's all the crew. But you know what? There's people you still don't see that help put these shows on and help do a lot of work in the ACA. Can I call you out? Can I call you out? Okay. Larry Gleason. I wanted to make sure. Larry, some of you guys may know him. He has been around for a long time, and he is one of the unsung heroes. I think that's the first time you've ever been on camera, isn't it, Larry? And he was there as a questioner. And and Larry is a huge force behind in the ACA. He's done our books and done so much, and he's one of those unsung heroes. And, you know, I don't know what he feels about it, but as a former board member, I can tell you that he has done a ton of work for free for us. And I think we've paid him a little bit too, but I don't think we've paid him what he's worth. But there are people like that everywhere, right? And so if you're looking for something to do that is very low key and low risk, either go be one of those people in the very, very background, or go help those people that are in the background. Mm-hmm. Right? We all get...
I help you.
Yeah, I know. So, yeah, that's my girlfriend, by the way. That's why I was so nervous about her question. Uh-huh. But yeah, that's the, you know...
That. He's afraid right now. That's the problem. And he has every right to be. He has to ride home with me.
Yeah, there's no mute button on this one, so I can't get it to go quiet either. yeah, I've got the big microphone, hon. Remember that? Oh.
Yes, but you're trapped behind glass. Remember that?
Yes. So anyway, getting back to the topic, everybody, even if what you can give is just showing up at a show or going to a conference and walking around and supporting a conference or anything along those lines, there is no too little to help out. And yeah, there's a lot of burnout right now. We look at the Supreme Court and we go, oh my God. But you know what? We need to kind of start talking to our representatives and say, hey, maybe we need to put some more people on the Supreme Court. What are you guys going to do about it? What are we going to do about the situation we're in, right? And I have to be kind of careful because this is a nonprofit. But yeah, those are the things we need to do. And sometimes throwing in the towel and going to Cancun, that's a thing. Right.
I'm all for that one. Well,
yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think that's the best answer we can give is there is nothing we can do except give as much support to those people who are in the
fight. Then I guess what you're saying is prioritize self over changing the country.
Can't take care
of anybody.
Or at
the very least, keep yourself in mind, yeah. Right? Like there's a trade-off for sure, but you know, as a working as a counselor,
well, in my case,
I think we talk about.
Think yeah. I have to prioritize self because my job is already going to suck out everything else. So
right? Yeah.
I don't think I can keep up the fight for the country and save lives. I think I have to pick one.
Yep.
So
there's a balancing act for all of us, and just to stress that taking care of yourself is not an inherently inherently selfish or immoral act. It is instead a vital and necessary one. And so I hope that everybody will continue to think about, well, do I feel safe living here? What can I contribute to my community? But also, what do I need to just stay safe and stay sane and keep contributing, whatever that might look like for you?
All right, thanks. All right. And I think that is it for...
All right, so getting a little tight. Can we do either Steve or Ty, or I don't know how much time we got left.
We got about 10 minutes. So let's just do this one.
All right.
All right. Steve in Florida, how can we help today?
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Hey, not too bad. In your mind.
That's good. I'm calling because I'm in the process of becoming atheist, walking away from religion. Mm-hmm. And one of the hardest things for me is giving up the hope of seeing, like, my son died when he was 5 of brain cancer. So, you know, the hope of seeing them again that religion gives you, you know, even though logically, you know, it's, there's no good reason to believe it.
Yeah.
You still have that hope, you know, and it's, it kind of sucks when you realize that that's not real.
Yeah. No, so that, that's an incredible pain.
If you had any advice on, you know, how to help get through that.
Yeah. You know, as far as the how, I think that that's going to differ for everybody. The thing I probably really want to stress is that you don't have any sort of timetable or quota that you need to hit. You know, I think the trap that a lot of folks fall into, especially if they're in a place where they're beginning to deconstruct their faith, is everything becomes very logical and narrow, and this is what makes sense, and this is what is true. And that's not a bad thing necessarily, but you have to be really careful not to just should all over yourself. You know, you can say, well, I shouldn't feel this way or I shouldn't think that way, but that's not going to change whether or not you do think that way. And we can recognize that our feelings are here and they matter whether they make sense or not. You know, we can have thoughts and emotions that aren't rational, and we need to treat them differently than the things that are rational. But if we're just beating ourselves over the side of the head over and over again, saying, oh, I shouldn't think that, I shouldn't think that, I shouldn't think that, then we're really not getting anywhere closer to healing. As far as how to cope with that incredible loss and how to wrap your head around all of this, I can imagine it being a really painstaking process. What has your experience been up to this point? How are you feeling? What's working?
Well, I mean, I don't know if... I definitely understand what you're saying, because it's very easy to kind of fall into an almost nihilistic view as you go through this process. Mm-hmm. And you realize that, you know, something you've believed your whole life is, you know, a lie. And, you know, as you come to grips with the fact that you, you know, essentially have believed in Santa Claus, you know, as an adult, sure, for your whole life, it makes it, it's difficult. I mean, I don't know what works because I haven't found it yet, but the single most difficult part of it for me, you know, is that hope, that, because that's the one thing, you know, that gets you through when you have a loss like that. At least it was for me at the time of his death. And giving up that hope, you know, that's the most difficult part of walking away entirely from, you know, these beliefs that I no longer believe. Yeah, and for me, seeing how Christian nationalism is starting to, you know, take over in this country and things, that those are the kinds of things that have pushed me away from religion, you know, mm-hmm, more and more so, and got me to the point where, you know, I no longer believe. You know, the only thing that is still remaining is, you know, a desire to hold on to that hope, even though I know that logically that's not, you know,
yeah,
there's no good reason to believe that either. So
I mean, I think Christy, I think you're trying to get her to this, maybe a little more blunt than you just were. It's okay to have that hope, even if it's irrational. It's okay to have a few irrational things in your life. As long as they're not hurting you or hurting anybody else, it's okay. And to have this irrational hope that you'll see or talk to your son again, that's okay. You don't have to be perfectly rational every single day. It's not possible. We have plenty of evidence to show that if you take out the emotional centers of the brain, we cannot make decisions. we can't make the decision to eat. We know we have to. We may agree that we have to, but we can't make the decision to do so if you take out and burn out the emotional centers of our brain. So it is absolutely 100% okay for you to have this irrational hope, as long as it's not negatively affecting you, right? Or anybody else. It's okay.
Right. Well, I guess that's encouraging, at least for now, you know, until I get to the point where I don't feel like I need it to, you know, get out of bed every day.
Yeah.
So that's, I appreciate that advice, even though, you know, it goes, it goes against wanting to believe as many true things as I can and not believe as many false things as I can. But,
well, and that word belief is tricky, right? Like, what is it that we actually believe? And is it only what we can demonstrate on paper? Or do we subconsciously carry around with us beliefs, rational and irrational, tested and untested, all the time? Ultimately, I guess what I would really like to encourage you to do is just notice the places where you're being aggressive towards yourself. Notice the places where you're saying, this is how I need to feel, or this is wrong, or this needs to be fixed. This is a problem in the way that I'm thinking. And just recognize that you don't always have to make sense. It's great when you do. I mean, that's sort of the goal. That's what we're aiming towards. But punishing yourself, being upset with yourself, being angry at yourself because there are thoughts and feelings that you don't like or that you don't want to have is not going to make those feelings go away. It's just going to complicate them. I hate to say it, but when we're talking about grief, you have to just move through it at a pace that feels right for you. Don't feel like you owe it to anybody to fix these feelings. Just allow yourself to feel them as you can while caring for yourself in the best possible ways. And of course, you know, being in community, working with a qualified professional, having support from the people around you. I mean, these things really, really do matter. And I don't want to make any assumptions about your life, Steve, but I just want to really stress that as you go through this process, there's not a right way to do it. There's not an obligation to do it at any particular pace. But whatever you're doing is not going to be benefited from self-criticism, is not going to be benefited from harming yourself or being aggressive or angry at yourself. If you can just accept, I have these miserable feelings and they're miserable, well, that's probably going to feel pretty miserable, but it is part of the path towards healing. And I hope that you can find support and kindness and comfort and nourishment so that those miserable parts are maybe just a little bit more bearable.
Well, thank you very much for that. And, you know, I would say that your words were those things more than, you know, so thank you for that.
Hey, glad that we can do anything at all. I really appreciate you being brave enough to kind of call in and just share your experience with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. All right, well, hey, thank you. You guys have a good one.
All right, you too.
Appreciate it.
Talk to you later. And that brings us to the end of the show. Which
first one back in studio. I mean, I hate to see it go.
Yeah, I do too. Although I think the crew is trying to tell us to shut up now because they made the studio completely dark.
Anyway. Everybody's all ready for the after show. If you're watching this online, I guess you're just going to need to be here for the next one.
Yeah. And speaking of the crew, can we get them on camera so we give them a proper round of applause for putting this show on? There they are.
So many more than the people you see here, but we're so grateful for each of y'all.
Round of applause. Thank you guys so much for being here. Thanks to crew so much for doing all the hard work behind the scenes and allowing us to just be a couple of talking heads on a screen. We appreciate it more than you guys know. We appreciate you folks being here more than you know.
Deeply.
And thank you so much. And so that will end the show for the day. We'll see you guys next time. And those of you who are here, I think there's food and some coming soon. So
we'll grab your back cruise tickets. We'll see you.
Yeah.
It's time to get sexy. So watch Secular Sexuality Live Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central. Visit tiny.cc/YTSS and call into the show at 512-991-9242 or connect to the show online at tiny.cc/callsex.